Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, all you jazz babies and darlings and wonders of the World Wide Web. Welcome to Broadway Breakdown. I am Matt Koplik. Today with me is a dear, 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 old friend. He's just as big of a theater nerd as I am. I wouldn't say as angry about it as I am, but just as passionate. Please welcome to the pod, my dear friend, Adam Elsberry.
Hello.
Hi, Adam.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming back. Adam Adam is joining me today to break down a decades-long debate, 20 years exactly, the greatest debate in theater of this century, which is, which Wild Party is better? The Michael John Lacusa, George C. Wolfe version or the Andrew Lippa version?
Chat room girl voice?
That's my chat room girl voice. I have two voices. I have my chat room gay voice, which is what I just did. My little Betsy voice.
Right.
And then I have my jaded gay, which is the, which version is better? It's just a male Mae West. So I say welcome back because, full disclosure, I had Adam come on yesterday when we recorded this to settle the great debate of which Wild Party is officially better. Because every year or every 2 years, it always comes up somewhere in the internet. Broadway World is the message boards that I'm always trolling, and somebody posted it a couple of days ago. And, it's the same old story. Somebody has their favorite, somebody has their favorite, and everybody tries to make a case for theirs, but no one ever really tries to go into the nitty-gritty and really kind of delve into what either show is trying to do and, how they succeed and fail. And I had Adam come on and we talked about it and it was lovely, went on for a long time. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, I'm going to cut this down. I'm going to make this one, semi-long episode. And I was listening to it and I was like, this is so inside baseball because Adam and I were trying to cover absolutely everything in like as short a period of time as possible. And when we kiki about theater, like our brain just, you guys know me and you know John, like we go on tangents all the time. Adam is like me and John combined. So it's like, it was a combustion of tangents, all relevant, but just like the train went off the rails. And I was like, I'm having a blast listening to this. I don't know who actually would.
Oh yeah, we were taking sidecars, we were taking cabooses, we were on every scope of that rail.
We were both on the express route and the scenic route, like at the same time.
And, hills and valleys, babe.
And it was lovely, but I was like, for anybody who isn't really aware of either version, or even if you're only really aware of one version, like it was just simply too inside baseball,
and a little chaotic,
which
honestly, is appropriate.
It's appropriate considering the subject matter.
Right.
So I asked him to come back for a redo because I've decided right here, right now, for the first time in Breakdown Herstory, we're going to have a two-parter of an episode. Snap, snap,
yes.
Snap. Yes. Because I want to do justice to both versions of Wild Party and not like shortchange what they're about, what they do, the songs, the characters, the moments. And I don't want to have to continue to re-explain something for people if they don't know it. So this first part episode is going to be a brief rundown on the history of both versions and their original productions, how they were received, as well as like a kind of run through, like a performance run through of both versions, sort of from first song to last song. Not super long, but you know, enough so that way you know what we're talking about when we analyze them. Then part two is us objectively analyzing both and coming up with a firm decision on which one is better. Ooh. So if you do know both versions, you can skip right ahead to part two.
I mean, if you want.
I mean, I'm just saying, like, it is, we are in the upside down and we have nothing but time. So like,
that's true.
take the time for two parts. Having recorded this once already with Adam, I can tell you it's going to be fun. We're fun bitches.
I mean, the number of podcasts that I've listened to where people talk about a movie that I've watched a million times, I'm like, I know the synopsis, but I'll still listen to somebody else say it. Who knows?
There's a whole episode of How Did This Get Made? I think it's about Teen Witch. It's like 2.5 hours long. And I've seen Teen Witch so many times, but I listened to all of it. I would say listen to both. But if you truly are like, my time is precious, first of all, congratulations. You are so special. Listen,
if you got stuff to do right now, I am jealous because I'm daily trying to find things to fill every hour of the day because I got nothing. So
truly why you agreed to come back and re-record today.
Oh yeah, you said when do you have free time? And I was like, well, what time is it? Because I could really go right now if you need me to.
I mean, I really was doing you a favor. Full disclosure, before we get into how we got introduced to these and the history of everything, Adam and I both are bigger fans of the Lacusa version.
Truth.
However, that does not necessarily mean we are going to be biased in our analyzation. We are truly... Is analyzation a word? Did I make that up?
No, it's a word.
Okay, great. You know, sometimes like something sounds real and it sounds good.
Right. I mean, I've said it at some point. So if it's not a word, then we've both made it up. So
I mean, sometimes there's just bridges. There are bridges you crossed you didn't know you crossed until you crossed. Mm-hmm. Let us rejoiceify. So it's...
No, going back and revisiting both of these shows at the same time, because I don't think I've ever done a side-by-side with them.
Same.
I sort of had like a moment where I've really like gone deep into one and then like listened to the other, but not like... to really yeah. sit down and compare them. So doing this has actually made me look at both of them with a little bit more of an analytical eye than I probably had before, instead of just like a visceral, I love this one. Like, yes. This is the one that does it for me. It's actually been great to revisit just because, I don't know.
Yeah.
And it's fun to analyze.
It's fun. Who doesn't love digging deep? But to quote Uma Thurman, on Smash, I'm here to dig deep. Mm. Saying something's your favorite, people mistake saying favorite for what they think is best. Mm. So when someone says like, what's your favorite movie? What's your favorite play, musical, whatever? You're not necessarily saying that you think it's the one that's the best of everything. It's just the one that you gravitate towards the most.
Right.
Like there are books that I reread all the time because it's easy to do and I'm always invested and just, it's a chemical reaction. It's not me sitting down and like making a pro and con list and saying, I've objectively decided this one's the best and thus it is my favorite.
Oh, for sure. I mean, how many times are you like, this is my favorite movie to watch when I'm cleaning the house? Or, you know, there's qualifiers involved. I mean,
just because I do crunches to Dead Girl Walking from Heathers does not mean I think Dead Girl Walking is a better song than Send in the Clowns. Just one is not the song you do crunches to. Everyone who listens to this pod knows I'm an opinionated asshole, and thus like I make my opinions known. And you might ask yourself, hey Matt, if you really wanted this to be even and level and truly a debate, wouldn't you have brought on a gay who was more into the Lipa version so it could be more balanced out? Yes, I could have, but first of all, go fuck yourself. I'm not going to do that.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the
top. You're a Coolidge dollar. What is The Wild Party? What is it based off of and what's it about? Adam?
Oh, I'm telling a story. Oh my God. All right. Well, The Wild Party is based on a poem from the late 1920s. You're going to have to tell me the name of the author because I'm blanking. Oh no, what is his name? Something March. Joseph Moncure March is his name.
Yes.
Was the name of the original poet. So it's a sort of scandalous poem of the late 20s that focuses around a couple who are sort of bottom of the barrel performers. One is a Corrine and the other is a clown. They have a very tumultuous relationship and for one reason or another decide that they're going to invite all their friends over for a sort of scandalous fun party. The apartment is filled with all sorts of riffraff, I guess we could say. Mm-hmm. Like performing type riffraff. Mm-hmm. Over the course of the evening. Everything sort of comes to blows when Queenie's best friend Kate shows up with a gentleman on her arm who over the course of the evening Queenie falls for, ends up in bed with, and Burrs, her clown boyfriend, freaks out and ends up having a tussle with the boyfriend Black and a gun and ends up getting shot.
Yes.
I think that's pretty much it. Isn't that very much it?
It is, and it's quite a long poem considering how thin the plot is. Because it is sort of just like a series of pieces that you were told about the party. It's all told obviously in third person, and it has, you know, what is now a very famous opening, which is Queenie, who's the main character. Queenie was a blonde and her age stood still and she danced twice a day in vaudeville. And the poem was scandalous at the time because it was really kind of this expose of the dark side of New York City, of the jazz age, of the entertainment industry. You know, these people...
And we're still in the middle of Prohibition.
Yeah, and it was right before the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. So America was going through this, you know, everything is free and easy, everything's amazing, you know, the money is flowing, champagne is flowing, or I guess Prohibition was happening, so it wasn't flowing.
Bathtub gin was flowing,
behind closed doors it was flowing. Right. And this idea that everything is wonderful, and that mentality had kind of continued in pop culture for many a decade. You don't see many works in the first couple of decades of like movies and theater that really discuss the dark underbelly of it all. You have some like All About Eve, which talks about the ageism with women in the industry, mm-hmm. but it doesn't go as deep as say The Wild Party does, which has homosexuality and domestic violence and attempted rape and just a lot of subject matter that people either never knew existed or were uncomfortable talking about. And it's a, We read the poem today and it seems almost tame because it is, you know, rhyming couplets and it's very kind of point by point. Charles Isherwood in his review for the Andrew Lippa version called the poem Dr. Seuss on the Sauce, which I think is brilliant.
Pretty good.
Yeah. And it famously was banned in Boston when it came out. Yeah. And so both versions are based off of this. Lecuza started writing his around 97 because he... got a year-long residency with the Public Theater where George C. Wolfe was artistic director and, you know, said, we will pay you to write something. And he decided he was going to do Wild Party, which is important to remember because the Public Theater ended up producing the Wild Party on Broadway. It was a very scandalous thing because the Public Theater is a nonprofit off-Broadway theater. And in the past, anything they'd ever had on Broadway was a transfer. This was the first show they ever had that, like, was directly opening on Broadway.
Right.
Whereas Lippa's started about a year or two earlier, was in constant readings, did a workshop with the Eugene O'Neill Center, and then premiered that same year with the Manhattan Theater Club, which is why people often talk about the two and compare them, not just because they're based on the same source material, but because they opened in the same year in New York City. Within months of each other. One off Broadway, one on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And before we get really truly into it, I just want to say art is subjective. nothing is good or bad by fact. It's all about how you perceive it, where you are in your journey in life when you come upon it, how you process it, and truly everything is up for debate. Now, with that out in the open, take everything I just said and throw it out the fucking window, because we are going to compare art. And this is perhaps truly the only time I can think of where it makes sense to do so, because it is the same source material, it's the same plot, it's the same title, and it's truly how two different artists approached the exact same material. Mm-hmm. And so you can look at the two side by side and go, which one is more compelling, which one's more effective, which one makes more sense, which one's truer to the source material, yada, yada, yada.
Well, and not only that, just the fact that they were both adapted around the same time. It's mm-hmm. not like, you know, comparing something that was adapted, you know, in 1975, and then 20 years later, somebody did it and you're trying to compare it. These are both written within the same time in actual, you know, life timeline history too.
Yeah.
So they're living in the same time period in New York with similar surroundings, I guess I would say.
So now let's get into like the nitty gritty with both versions. We have the Andrew Lippa version, which once again premiered with Manhattan Theater Club in February of 2000. And the rumor was that it was going to probably go directly to Broadway. I was reading some articles to the New York Times, New York Post, and the basic understanding was Footloose at the Richard Rogers was starting to lag. And if they could convince the Niederlanders, like, it was going to move to the Richard Rogers in May right before the Tony deadline and probably run for a limited time or move to another theater, depending how well it did, because Seussical was already planning on coming in the fall. And which we saw how that went. But what ended up happening was the reviews were very mixed, with really only Clive Barnes, the New York Post, liking it. Everyone else was kind of like, it's very safe. They were being compared to the revival of Cabaret that had just come out because the aesthetics seemed very similar, and everybody would just sort of said, this isn't really it.
Right. Lots of eyeliner and garter belts.
Yes. 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 And then also like lots of high belting, which is, again, something we'll come back to. But, you know, it seemed to be like almost an underdog at the time, because the Broadway version had even greater star power and had more money behind it and was considered, you know, and Michael John Lacusa was more prominent in the community than Andrew Lippa was. Andrew Lippa had some stuff. He had John and Jen, and he wrote some stuff for Charlie Brown for the revival. But like Lacusa had just had Marie Christine, which granted, like, did not do super well, but it was his first Broadway show. He had Hello Again by this point. He had First Lady Suite. So like he was known and was considered a strong voice for future songwriters. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot riding on this one. And then George C. Wolfe, who is iconic, who co-wrote it and directed it. And we'll get into sort of his influence on that Wild Party as well. But so going into casting wise, we have Lippa's, which do you remember the list? Yes.
Sure. So for the main characters in the Lippa version, for Queenie, we've got Julia Murney, Brian D'Arcy James is playing Burrs, Taye Diggs is playing Black, we've got Idina Menzel as Kate, and then, you know, the rest of the cast includes tons of people who we still see just all the time. Lawrence Kegwin was featured as Jackie. Now he has a dance company of his own that's really prominent. I know, crazy. But Kevin Cahoon, Jennifer Cody, Alex Corey, Felicia Finley, just Megan Sikora, people who I think are maybe more recognizable now than they might have been at the time.
Yeah.
But an incredibly vibrant group of people.
Yes. A lot of mainstays of the community. If you don't, mm-hmm. also, if you don't know who Alex Corey is, and I have a feeling some of the listeners don't know who she is, try to find the 1980 Pirates of Penzance cast recording, the one that Kevin Kline and Linda Ronstadt, she plays the second lead sister. So Linda Ronstadt's the sister, she's the ingenue, but her other sister, who's like the other leader, is played by Alex Corey. And all you need to do is listen to Climbing Over Rocky Mountain, which, first of all, that arrangement slaps. Second of all, I'm obsessed with the synthesizers and xylophones. But Alex
and the trombone.
And the trombone. But Alex Corey fully has like this lovely lilting soprano for a second. It's like, let us gaily tread the measure. And then comes back with a hard belt of every moment brings a treasure. Yes. It's so good.
She goes from a lovely mezzo moment to just full on belting. It's pretty amazing.
Absolutely. And like from the throat with the healthiest of vibratos, I'm obsessed. Look into her. She's
it's
great.
On it is on Spotify and Apple Music if you have one or other of either of those platforms. Yes.
And there's also a video of that production when it was still at the Delacorte before it moved to Broadway. It's yes. on YouTube, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And you can see her because her comedic timing is great. The whole reason she goes into the belt is the sisters like interrupt her kind of with right. or like a call. So it's in the music, like it's a call and response. We're also getting so off topic, but fuck it. I'll take a moment to acknowledge Alex Corey. The sisters have their call and response with the and she stomps her foot or she like slaps her fan or something like that to kind of shut them up, sort of like, this is my moment. And so and in order to be like, this is my moment, bitch, it's like her Natalie Portman Black Swan, it's my turn, makes her like as a character. She then goes into the belt because she's like doing the lilty mezzo soprano thing, and then she gets interrupted and she's like, bitches, belt. She's like, right. I'm angry now because my moment has been ruined.
Right.
Oh, so good. Mean, it's yeah. great.
Also increasing my love for Linda Ronstadt, whose voice I'm convinced could just do anything at that point.
But you know what Linda Ronstadt wasn't in? The Broadway cast of The Wild Party, which is the list I want to get to next.
Yeah.
So if you thought that the Lipa Wild Party had a phenomenal cast, kid, check out this Broadway cast of The Wild Party.
Well, and I'll quickly say, as far as the Lipa one goes, it veered a lot younger. Mm-hmm. Where the Lacusa version, I would say, is a definitely a broader spectrum of age
and race and sizes and vocal type and acting type. It was so we'll get so yes, just a 5 second like recourse. As I said, the Lipa version was met with sort of mixed reviews. The Lacusa version was met with wildly varied reviews. Some were huge raves, like Isherwood and Variety loved it. One of my favorite quotes is the Observer in London called it a lunatic kamikaze attack on Disney. Which I think is like, if you were to sum up that, if the Lacusa Wild Party in one fell swoop, that would be it. But then you also had John Simon, who thought it was like the biggest disaster to hit Broadway in years. And Ben Branley in The Times, he described it as the Lipa version was a party with no personality, whereas the Lacusa version was a parade of personalities with no party. Basically saying, while the Lacusa one had more distinguishable talent and ideas, the Lipa one was more enjoyable, even if he didn't think it was all that interesting. So that is something to remember as we come back to an analysis. So who's in this cast for Lacusa, Adam?
All right, the Lacusa cast, we've got, starting off, as we've already mentioned, with my gal, fuck you, Toni Collette, that bitch. I love her.
Pretty sure that's how she's listed in SAG. Fuck you, Toni Collette.
We've got Mandy Patinkin as Burrs. We have Eartha Kitt playing the role of Dolores. We have Mark Kudish. Tanya Pinkins as Kate. Norm Lewis. Michael McElroy. Let's see who else we've got as far as like incredibly recognizable. Well, I wouldn't want to say that your favorite is not a recognizable name. Well-renowned Sally Murphy. Yes.
Sally Murphy, yes.
Your love.
I would argue she was probably more recognizable then when the show came out.
Sure, because she was almost fresh off of Carousel. It was only a couple of
years after. Yeah, it was only a couple years after Carousel, so she was still, like, a person.
Yeah.
She's still a person, but at the time.
Rounding out the cast, we have Nathan Lee Graham, who I love. We have Adam Gruper. Stuart Zagnett played his partner. And we had Brooke Sunny Moriber, who was almost fresh off of Parade at that point.
Parade and the Den. She was fresh off of both of those.
And then lastly, Jane Summerhaze, who...
Tony nominee for Me and My Girl. Some of you might know her as the woman who blows a finance guy under the table on season 3 of Sex and the City.
Right. Oh, and I'd be remiss. I'm sorry. I didn't mention Yancy Arias, who plays Black, who most people would recognize from television, not from...
Yes, mostly television. And then Leah Hawking, who is also a big Broadway...
Oh, my God. How Broadway did I forget Leah Hawking?
So, like, everyone on this podcast knows my love of Sally Murphy. My only complaint about her role in this Wild Party is you have her, and she has one line of dialogue, and that bitch does dialogue like nobody's business, and I'm pissed that she only has one line.
But she sings. She sings
a little bit. She doesn't sing until the second half, which is like, know when you have an ace up your sleeve and you're going to use that ace for the second half. But
sure.
So let's go into both versions. Let's start with Lipa's, because that's what technically opened first. Right. And if he's to be believed, he started writing it first. Both shows have the same title for the opening number and same opening lyrics. But Lipa's, we have this sort of bluesy, jazzy opening prologue. Mm-hmm. Called Queenie Was a Blonde, and I would say like 70% of the lyrics in this are from the poem.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 60. It starts to change once he gets into revealing Burrs, but it is all third person, where Queenie's singing about herself and the chorus is singing about her. Andrew Lipa really loves the lyric, her legs were built to drive men mad. He really kind of emphasizes that over and over again, and it is a true tried and true kind of opening number. It introduces our two main characters and gives a backstory of how they met and why they're connected, so that way we understand for the rest of the show why they're continually tied to each other.
And it makes it very clear that their relationship is entirely built around their sexual chemistry.
Yes.
Queenie was a blonde and her age stood still, and she danced twice a day in vaudeville. Queenie was a blonde, and if looks could kill, she would kill twice a day in vaudeville. She had gray eyes, lips like coals aglow, and her face was a tinted mask of snow. With those shoulders, what a back she had. Her legs were built to drive men mad.
And I mean, if I'm putting my opinion in there, I think it's a little overly simplified of this kind of situation, but Lipa tries to give this idea that Burrs, who we are told is mean and violent and aggressive, doesn't actually want to be that way. It's because he can't find... Oh God, I can't believe I have to say these words because I hate it so much. Like, he hasn't found the right girl. And I'm like, ugh.
It sort of defends his violent nature. Well,
yeah, there's literally the line, he didn't want to be bad. And this is making it sound like I'm already trying to set up the Lipa version to fail. I'm not. It's just, it's one of those things where, like, the intention is right. You're trying to give us a reason to want to watch these characters.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of those things where I'm like, but in the grand scheme of musical theater writing, Lip is doing what he's supposed to be doing, which is he is setting the scene for our two main characters and attempting to give us a reason to want to watch them. And we're not going to go like super in depth as we go through each show, but we do want to kind of hit some major beats, because there are some things that both versions do not the same, but they like certain scenes or plot points or character moments that both versions hit on. So we want to make sure that we acknowledge those moments as we talk about them.
Right.
Yes. So the apartment, do you want to take this one away?
Just in terms of what the scene is?
Yeah. What the scene is, what it does.
The apartment scene sets up ultimately why the party happens. It's a hot morning. The two of them are both getting up, I think presumably from performing the night before. So they're both hungover and hot. And Queenie's kind of whiny and needy. Mm-hmm. And it pisses Burrs off. He's easily pissed off and ultimately calls her a lazy slut. Mm-hmm. And the two of them have a tussle and he's about to hit her and she pulls a knife on him. And we sort of introspectively go into Queenie's mind of it's effectively her I want song of wanting to get out of there and find a new life, which in this version is called Out of the Blue, which mm-hmm. is the song we go into, which leads us into their decision to have the party. In this particular version, It's Queenie's decision to have the party. She decides to have it more than anything out of a as a revenge on Burrs to make him jealous and maybe rekindle their relationship and his affections for her. Out of the blue, your choices now are growing new. Today is what you make and how you make it. The step is yours to take, but can you take it?
I think a lot of the songs in the Lipa version are technically very well structured and well written on a level of what makes a song work. It's why so many of them work out of context.
Right.
And like when you see them in a concert version or whatever. Out of the Blue musically for me is perhaps one of my favorite songs in the show. I do love the motif when she brings up the idea of the party to Burrs. It's the do, 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 do. I think we're due for a party. Don't you? Don't you? Because it has this sort of energy about it that is full of promise and danger and like a little bit of sex.
That good old plotting music.
Mm-hmm.
She's making a plan.
It's truly plotting music.
It's plotting music.
Yeah, because it's not even like she's wandering the apartment. She's like slinking over like, I have an idea.
It's that like rubbing your chin like,
Yeah, but this is the wild party, so it's rubbing your nips.
One hand on your chin, one hand on the left nip.
I'm sorry, is that not how everyone else thinks? So we go from Out of the Blue into, what's it called? And the gang, oh no, What a Party. It's called What a Party. Which is bringing all the guests in. And it maintains the Greek chorus, third person, like narration of what's happening and brings in all the guests of the party. And we're told about Eddie and May, who's a boxer and she's his girlfriend. Madeline Shrew, who's a stripper, in this version, she's not a stripper, she's a lesbian.
That's her profession. She's a professional lesbian.
And they dress Alex Corey in a full-blown tuxedo. The brothers Darmano, who are pianists, composers.
They're brothers in the biblical sense.
Yes, and it is unclear. In both versions, in both the poem and in the different musical versions, if they're actually brothers or if they are lovers who are presenting as brothers professionally. So there's no question as to why they're always together.
I had sort of always assumed that it was a like a stage moniker and that they were just a duo.
Yeah. Which for me also makes sense. There's something very, you know, like seedy about them though being twin gay brothers who are into each other, you know. Listen, Pornhub has said that incest is like the number one researched word on their search function, so clearly people are thinking it. So we go into What a Party and everyone shows up. They have Nadine, a minor, and everyone goes ooh, which is gets a laugh from the audience, which tells you a lot about the different perspectives of
and
these two.
Eye roll from me, sorry.
Yeah. And then we go into Queenie's entrance in the party and her sort of welcoming of everyone to it, which is the song Raise the Roof. I will say, What a Party, and I told you this when we were texting as I was listening to it, in a lot of ways, You're in Town has ruined a lot of musical theater for me, because I can't now listen to What a Party and not think of, like, Snuff That Girl. It's like, and the gang took, bam.
Yeah.
Bum, bum, bum. And all I'm thinking is like the group of working class people in Urinetown.
Gung, gung, gung.
Yeah. With a gung, like, gung, that's, gung. All, that's all I can think of. Urinetown has ruined that for me. By this point, we've now had like jazz, we've had old school musical theater, we've had pop, we've had rock. Like the Lipa version is very a melting pot of various genres.
He definitely enjoys a Latin beat.
Who doesn't?
Him and David Yazbek, living for the Latin beats.
Listen, I'm for... Her name is Valentina, and her eyebrows are beautiful. Don't just call her a Latin beat.
She's beautiful. She's gorgeous. She looks like
Linda Evangelista. Yeah. She stoned those tights herself. So
we go into
Raise the Roof, which is plot-wise, it's just welcoming everyone to the party, and it is very belty, belty, belty. It's not on the cast recording, but it actually has one of my favorite jokes in the musical. And I don't mean this nastily. Like, I actually think it's quite funny. When she asks Madeline how she's feeling, she goes, "I'm hungry." And she means that in every sense of the word. And they go, right. "Well, there's lots of men, lots of food and lots of women." And Queenie goes, "Where else can you find that in one place?" And there's a beat. And Madeline True goes, "Prison."
Yeah.
And I think that's a genuinely funny joke.
It is funny.
Then go into a little piece where, like, the party's starting to happen. It's not on the album, but there's an element of the show that they really try to hit home just how desirable Queenie is, how she is like the goddess divine, which I think is unfair to any woman who plays Queenie, because audiences are going to sit there and judging her from their perspective of like, well, is she a goddess? I don't know. Right. And it objectifies the actress when it's supposed to be talking about Queenie. And I think that's an unfair advantage. I just want to put that out there right now. It's something that's always bothered me.
I can see that.
It's something that's in a lot of other shows where it's like everyone on stage is desiring this one woman so hard and makes audiences go like, well, it's not my aesthetic. She's not that much of a goddess. It's like, don't blame the actress for playing the role. Like, this is a talented, beautiful woman. It's not her fault that the character is being described as like lusted after by every single person who's ever walked the earth.
Well, but you know, I mean, to be fair, Cheetah Rivera in Kiss of the Spider Woman doing Gimme Love and all of these men lusting after her. And I love Cheetah Rivera and I think she's gorgeous, but she's not conventionally beautiful, but she radiates sex appeal and is.
Yes, but that's.
As a performer, if you can bring it, anybody can believe you're sexy.
Absolutely. But also, then you have the double standard of Cheetah Rivera was a legend when she did Kiss of the Spider Woman. So there was already that aura of course you're going to lust after her. She's Cheetah Rivera. But if an unknown were to do that role, that audience would be like, I don't know. Is she that beautiful? It's that double-edged sword that's really unfair. And I bring it up because right before we go into the next song that's on the cast recording, there's a moment that you can find on video where Queenie is walking around the party like, which man am I gonna maybe suck off tonight? And she puts her hand on one guy's head and he shoots up the octave in musical ecstasy.
Who is that? That
I don't
performer.
Even know, but he's
this man is this this video does exist on YouTube if you look it up. Yeah. It's listed as Idina Menzel's Look at Me Now because that's the song it's leading into. But this whoever this performer is, I'm sorry I don't know your name if you're even listening to this.
Erasure. His name is now Erasure.
Incredible voice. Yeah, he has a vocal moment of just pure ecstasy that's up in the stratosphere of male voices, which is very much in the Stephen Arimus wheelhouse of just pushing the vocals as high as they can go. It's incredibly impressive.
It's like, I think you've got one more step in you. It goes very high up. And then we go straight into the entrance of best friend Kate in this version played by Idina Menzel. Right. And it is her introductory song called Look at Me Now.
To go on a slight tangent, it's one of those songs that you wouldn't want to sing in an audition because I think, didn't we all learn that you never want to do a song where the people behind the table can answer that question or respond to you if you're not good at it? when you don't want to be like, I'm the greatest star, and have that gay behind the table be like, oh no, bitch, you are not.
But that is why that is the other end of my whole, when you write a role that's all like, I'm the sexiest thing that's ever walked the earth, look, everyone lusts after me. The audience is like, oh no, you're not that sexy. Like, like rude, fucking rude.
Right.
So anyway, yes. Look at me now. And we have Kate introduce Black to Queenie and then goes into a quartet called Poor Child, where Black basically it's very like operatic melodramatic in a sense, because it's one of those things where each character that sings in the quartet has a different thought, but it's all sort of overlaps. So you have Black, who's seeing Queenie and sees the broken child inside underneath the hard exterior. Queenie, who is her doing her inner monologue that's very chorus line one, where she's like, look down, look up, shoulder glance, look over at Burrs, look back at Black, that kind of thing. And then Kate, who's like, I'm gonna go get me some Burrs, fuck you Queenie. And then Burrs, who's like, look at Queenie lusting after Black, which it's Taye Diggs, how can you not. And that's, but that's basically the song. It's very melodic and musically very satisfying, especially when you have really great singers. Virginal, sensitive, generous, poor child. We have a nice little detour for our token lesbian.
Right.
Which I just want to bring up quickly. It's just Madeline, the lesbian, looking around the party, looking for a woman to be with. And it's a comedic number. Where is that good-natured, old-fashioned lesbian love story, the kind that my mama used to tell?
It has a very... decidedly... It's clearly very influenced by Vile and Candor and Ebb. And it's kind of like the chorus bits kind of remind me of like Mary Sunshine from Chicago.
Yeah, very much that.
And then the verses remind me more of like Fräulein Schneider from Cabaret. It sort of goes back and forth.
Yes. Yes.
But it's clearly very influenced.
And the intro is very overture to Chicago. It's that do 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 do. It's
right. But it goes into that Vile vamp.
But that's all. That's all. Moving on. Nothing happens. It's just Madeline gets a moment and we never hear from her ever again.
Right.
Then we go back to our Greek chorus with By Now the Room Was Moving, and it's just another You're in Town. By Now the Room Was Moving. We're the Greek chorus today.
Right.
All snapping.
And the party, well, and so to scoot along a little bit, just because...
Yeah, go for it.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, the party sort of keeps itself going. Queenie and Burrs sort of throughout the evening continue to have little moments where they're aside moments with each other where threats are made regarding the attraction between one person and another. Mm-hmm. In this version, Kate is trying to rekindle a flame with Burrs that apparently once existed.
Yes.
So we sort of have this push and pull over the course of the evening, which ultimately leads to what was the song you were wanting to bring up? That's sort of a parallel.
Well, so we go into Juggernaut, which is just a number about the party, and then into a Wild Wild Party, which is, we don't really need to go into it. It's a production number where everybody in the party does a number that is.
It's a gospel workshop. Number.
It's a gospel number from a fictional musical that the brothers D'Armano are working on.
We sort of get deeper into the party and Queenie and Black have stepped aside for a little bit and we sort of get a little introspective on where she is in their relationship and I don't know, I guess she's trying to explain to Burrs, not Black. Burrs, she's, thank you. Hmm. She's trying to explain to Black, or convince herself. It's kind of a lie of a song, mm-hmm. where she's trying to convince herself that she is happy where she is, mm-hmm. but it's also kind of a silent plea to him to get her out of there.
Maybe I like it this way, yeah.
Yeah.
It is, it's, I'm still not entirely convinced what the motive of the song is. It is a little bit of What's the Use of Wondering meets,
As He Needs Me.
Yeah, I would actually argue it's a little more As Long As He Needs Me than it is What's the Use of Wondering. It is a little bit of like a declaration of, you know, I am happy with this lot because there's so much about this situation that I love, and I'm willing to take the bad. And it's sort of like Queenie acknowledges the danger that's there, but also like the danger is kind of what excites her. But I truly don't know. What makes the song so meaty is you can truly play it either way. You can play it as earnest and like declarative, or you can play it ambivalent and sort of like, I'm hiding how I truly feel with this mask of confidence.
Maybe tomorrow it comes crashing down. Maybe next week I'll find another clown. Maybe I'll try to go a different way. But look who's sitting here today.
So the party sort of reaches a climax where everybody's incredibly wasted and
yeah.
falling asleep on top of each other, essentially. Yes. And which gets us to a song that I know you wanted to talk about, which is Life of the Party, which is sung by Kate.
Yes. So Act 1 ends and Act 2 opens with Kate on stage, sort of like frozen in time. And it is a very Sally Bowles Life as a Cabaret Old Chum. And the song is called Life of the Party and is perhaps the most famous song from the show and is like the number one go-to for your high belting power girl in school for class, for concerts, for auditions, because it is a really musically sound song. It is structured really well. Once again, like, Andrew Lippa has an ear for earworms. He's got a gift for earworms, and he really knows how to structure a song so that way it builds the proper climax.
Right. Well, and I think we ultimately came to the decision or the agreement the last time we were talking about this, that the song ultimately, the best word to describe it is satisfying.
Yes. But it's sort of the theme of the show in a lot of ways, or at least the theme that a lot of the characters fall into with this version of Wild Party, which is like, it's going to end at some point. So you might as well be at the center of it all, living it up and having all eyes be on you.
Don't you want to land the role of a lifetime? Well, you better get down on one knee. Cause you could play the life of the party if you can pray with me.
But that is the gist of the song. And I only wanted to bring it up because there's a parallel to it from a different character at a different point in the Lacusa version.
Right.
So moving along, plot-wise, things are kind of getting hotter and more intimate with Black and Queenie. And Burrs is slowly starting to fall apart. And Burrs is like, I want this party to end, asks Queenie to call it off. And she basically says, like, no, we're not ending this party. It'll never end. Like, it's basically, dramatically speaking, Burrs has a match in his hand. And is, I should say, Burrs has accidentally spilled gasoline, or intentionally spilled gasoline, and has said to Queenie, let's get out of this room. And Queenie instead strikes a match.
I think that's a great analogy. Yes.
Thank you. I mean, some people say I'm smart, but, which goes into Burrs' big breakdown number, which is called Let Me Drown. And it is, how would you describe this song?
Well, I think if you told me that it was a breakdown number, I'd be surprised.
Yes.
It's a song. I guess I'd say it's another song that sort of has a gospel influence to it. Yeah, it's sort of an odd upbeat breakdown.
Well, there's a sinisterness about it, but it never actually feels dangerous, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Especially because the entire cast, minus Queenie and Black, obviously join him. Mm-hmm. So I think it's more scary to see someone break down alone because have no one be aware of it. Then you're like, well, what's going to happen? What's he going to do, or what's she going to do? But to have a whole company sort of see this happen and think, well, we'll join in anyway. It's like, either it becomes like the Wicker Man, where it just becomes this giant cult around a bonfire with bees, or it's like, well, it can't be that serious if everyone is seeing him act this way and is like joining in. It's like, oh, the fun.
And I'm just thinking of Nicolas Cage playing Burrs.
Let me drown this evening, let me drown.
Let me drown.
If I'm low, let me slowly paint the town. When they ask for the roof, let me answer 100 proof. Let me drown, 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 drown. Let
me so, drown Queenie and Black then have their mating ritual song called Come With Me, which has a really great beginning, but I think it's a 2.5 minute song that should be 45 seconds.
Yes.
It has a couple, and I know this is analytical, we're not like just sort of going through the show, but it has a lot of metaphors that make no sense to me. Like an actor on a stage, I'm howling. Like an eagle in the sky, I'm screaming. I'm like, is that like a term for an eagle in the sky? Screaming? Or does she mean like the hawking cry that an eagle makes? I don't know.
I don't know. Like a seed dropped by a skybird in a distant wood. I don't know. I mean,
how dare you? That is a metaphor for the economy. And
oh my God, shut up. Oh, we're not even going. No, stop. Okay.
Listen, we had a good thing going.
Let's get to the end of this.
Yeah, let's get to the end of this fucking show. We're getting to the end. We're getting it close. But we have a whole other wild party to get through.
Well, the good news is once we've explained the basic plot of everything, the second version of explaining the Lakusa one is not going to take as long, everybody.
No, because we're just going to really barrel through. And then they have sex. They sing "Come with Me," which leads them into the bed. And Queenie and Black have sex. Come with Me is their song that leads them to the bed. They have sex. Burrs comes in and with a gun and threatens both of them with it in a violent rage, which leads to the song "Make Me Happy," which musically is really glorious. But every time I've watched it, and even when I was in it, I was like, "This is a 5-minute song, and there's a gun on stage." Like, it's just, it doesn't. I don't know.
It's a moment of tension that would not, that should not last that long.
Yes, I have no problem with the song being there, and not even that song. It's just about, I think, and same thing with "Come with Me," where I'm like, this needs to get tighter. And the same thing is also true, and we'll get this with Lakusa, like there being an intermission in Wild Party. It's just very, it is very traditionally structured, and you have to ask yourself, does this traditional structure help the plot or lack thereof in any way? Right. But yeah, so "Make Me Happy" happens, which leads to a reprise of "Life of the Party," which, you know, once again reinforces the underlying theme with a lot of these characters. The gun gets shot, Burrs dies, Black goes on the lam, and Queenie sings "How Did We All Come to This?" And it is this sort of like come to Jesus moment, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm.
It's also like a diva worship moment because it's everything on stage is quiet. Julia Murney comes to the edge of the stage, crosses her legs, tears running down her face, and she's like, "I'm hydrated. My nasal passages are cleared from all the crying, and now I'm going to sing to you." So it's a little bit of both.
Right. And so to get to the end of it all, she sort of uses this song as a moment to revisit her thoughts of wanting to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And she puts on her coat and she walks out the door.
End of show. Moving
that
on.
Jazz, boom.
That jazz, boom. Now, Michael John Lacuse's.
Yeah.
Same opening number. Queenie Was a Blonde, but it does not open with our bluesy blues.
No.
How do we open, baby?
We're getting blasted. It's a chord that's used multiple times throughout the course of the show as sort of a theme of, I guess it's used anytime to sting a dangerous moment, really. Yes. within the show.
Queenie was a blonde and her age stood still, and she danced twice a day in the vaudeville. Gray eyes,
lips like coals aglow. Her face was a tinted mask of snow.
There's a lot of Sondheim in this.
Yes. So this opening number is decidedly a grindy burlesque number.
Yes. You used the term last time, and I want to bring it up again. We'll get to that one in a second. But in terms of the music, describes it as an angry jazz.
It's angry jazz.
And I think that is very heavily realized in the opening number, with not only that harsh chord, but then the drums leading into the scale into the opening number. Ba-da-da-da-da. It is this, it's hot and it's heated and it's muggy. It's very like, it's you almost can sort of sense the mugginess of New Orleans, right? Of just like being outside, and it's a
It's sweaty jazz.
Yeah, sweaty jazz.
I know we're not really comparing and contrasting, but just, I think at this point, since we've said the story, we can easily just say what some differences are. So the opening number, "Queenie Was a Blonde," is very decidedly specifically about Queenie. Mm-hmm. We don't explore the meeting of her and Burrs and what their relationship is necessarily. It's really just about her looks, her demeanor and mm-hmm. her sexuality. Lyrically, it's very slim. It goes off of the poem as well, and it's very similar to the introduction that we get in the Lipa one, but its focus is much more pinpointed.
Yes. And so while there is a moment where they do highlight the line, her legs were built to drive men mad, the first lyric that is really highlighted, and it's important because it serves the theme of the show, her face was a tinted mask of snow. That is the first lyric that really gets like a punch in the music. And that is important to remember when we come back to analyzing this in part two.
Right.
We also see Queenie do vaudeville in this number where we don't.
Right. She's doing a striptease in this striptease, opening.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And as you said, it's very simple. Like, this is Queenie. This is who she was. This is what she was about, what she liked, and what people thought of her. And then we move on into a song called Marie is Tricky, which introduces Burrs. And as opposed to the poem and the Lipa version where Burrs is a like red-nosed clown, in the Lacusa Wolf version, it is decided that Burrs is a clown who does blackface, like Al Jolson.
Right, he's a blackface comedian.
Yes. And that is also very important because race is a very major theme in this version of Wild Party, mm-hmm. and masks in particular, facade. If Queenie's wearing a tinted mask of snow, Burrs comes out in a veil of black. A literal opposite, veil of black. We go into the apartment that they live in. We see their kerfuffle.
Right. Well, and this whole scene, because we were talking about how this opening is, there's mm-hmm. there's a lot less development of who they are within mm-hmm. this opening. It's all very, it's sort of black and white. let's stick with this theme of black and white, shall we? But it is a sort of black and white. They're a couple. They fight a lot. We see the fight where she pulls the knife on him, mm-hmm. and the instigator for the party in this version, rather than her wanting to make Burrs angry, we sort of flip the table where, at least at face value, Burrs approaches her with having the party as a way to make it up to her for being a dick.
Put out the news, we got a high party. Put out the word and go and order the ice. We sure could use a little fun. Lover, when was the last time I wore my new backless? When was the last time you smiled? When was the last time we had a real party? Wet and wicked, best time fighting.
Which yes. leads into the parade of guests, mm-hmm. which similarly to the Lipa one, but in this version, we see everyone all at once.
Yes.
Parading across the stage. We're introduced to everybody by Burrs, who sort of introduces everyone to the front in the audience directly.
Yes.
To these characters on stage.
Like they are acts in the vaudeville almost, like this act that we're going to present later.
Right. Which is a song called Dry, which leads us into the actual apartment at that point where we see Queenie, who does the song, which is literally Welcome to My Party.
Yeah. Whereas Raise the Roof is sort of Queenie riling up everyone together and it's a group number. Welcome to My Party is decidedly Queenie singing. And it's
right.
all about her. And it has I would say it has a more frantic energy about it because there, as we mentioned before, one of the themes of the show is like the masks we all wear in society. And mm-hmm. in this particular Wild Party, that also translates to all these characters are in desperate needs and wants of something, mm-hmm. whether it's a person to love, whether it's to be accepted, whether it's to find happiness or excitement. And Queenie at this point in the show is very much desiring to find her next high, her next kick. And so there is a very driven, frantic energy to Welcome to My Party. And it's a very shallow kind of like, I'm the amazing sexual hostess. Hello, hello, hello.
Right. She's determined to have a good time.
Yes.
I gotta get my engine smoking. I need a bed and God, I need it more. I need a lot of friendly stroking. There ain't no heaven and there ain't no hell, no turning back. Daddy, lock the door.
After that, she sort of is working the room and you see how each person reacts differently to her. We also are given a more fleshed out perception of the guests already, just based off of little pieces of dialogue and music.
Right.
The character that Eartha Kitt plays is a character that is only briefly mentioned in the musical of Lipa's Dolores, who in the musical, with Lipa is called a hooker. And in the Lakusa one, she is a former actress of stage who was renowned in some regard. How famous, yet to be determined. And
but age got in the way.
Yes, because of how society treats women, specifically women of a certain age and women of color, she has three strikes against her. So she's gotten to a point where it doesn't matter how talented or determined or beautiful she is, she has a million obstacles in her way. So she's come to this party. Everyone who comes to this party has their own objective. And her objective is to come to this party with a job. Because everyone who's at this party is in the industry in some way, whether they're a performer, they're producers. There are two producers who come to this party, and Dolores basically sets sights on them from the word go and sinks her claws into them.
You're looking at a woman who invented the walk. You know the walk. I invented that. You're looking at a female who has driven men to homicide. How must you ask? Look at these beautiful legs. These legs were built to drive men mad. Would you like to die?
So Eddie and May have a song in this version, similar to Two of a Kind, but a little more, a little less cute.
Yes.
A little more about their actual problems that they're running into.
Yes.
where May used to be in the chorus with Kate and Queenie, but now she's decided to go domestic, and she's fat, and she's unhappy that she's living at home and not getting to. She's trying to convince herself that she loves being a supporter of her husband, who's a boxer.
Yes.
But she ultimately misses getting to be with her friends and perform.
Who is a black boxer, by the way, and is called the champ and the golden boy. And it's interesting in this song is, whereas in Two of a Kind, they're singing together and like sort of performing for the group. In Eddie and May, they are singing to two separate groups of people about each other. And they are separated in their verses, and then they come together towards the end. And it's really not until the very, very end of the song that they're actually in sync. Because they do like that, Eddie and May, and they're kind of like slightly off of each other. Mm-hmm. And then the final Eddie and May, they're actually in sync. And it's kind of this interesting foreshadowing of how not completely on the same page they actually are with each other.
Their evening goes real well.
Yes, and in the Lakusa version, Nadine, the minor, is May's sister, which is true of also the poem, whereas in the Lipa version, you don't really know why she's there. You don't know who invited her, what she's got to do with anything. She's also not really a part. I think she's got like two lines in the Lipa version. She has a song. Yeah, in the Lakusa version, you know, she's annoying, but she's sort of meant to be annoying when she, like, Queenie comes out and is being fabulous, or what Nadine thinks fabulous is.
Right.
And she sings her little, like, 16 bars. I was born to see the lights of Broadway. And Queenie literally goes, what's this? It's really fucking funny. And so we continue on with our characters. We meet Madeline. We meet Jackie, who is ambisextrous, played by Mark Kudish.
The brothers Germano, who fulfill the same purpose in this version, essentially.
Yes.
And ultimately, we finally get to Kate arriving with Mr. Black. Mm-hmm. And Queenie and Black's sort of immediate connection in this version.
Yes.
Which leads us to their flirtation in this show takes a lot more time.
Yes. It is an attraction that is not subtle, but their sexual and romantic draw to each other is not so obvious, if that makes sense. They both are masters of the sexual con. They don't show their hands to each other for a very long time.
They've found their matches in each other, essentially.
Yes. There's also, so whereas Lipa's version, Kate's introductory song is all about her, and Lakusa's, it's about Kate and Queenie's relationship, which is important because the relationship in the Lakusa version between these two is much different. Whereas in Lipa's, it's like, you know, they're friends, they've known each other, but like Kate's ulterior motives are to get to Burr's. Whereas in this one, these are truly soul sisters who like, they hate each other because they love each other because they've known each other.
It's a total bosom buddies kind of song.
Absolutely. Best friend, and it has such great stuff going on in it. And it's the underlying connection there is one of love. And because Kate is more successful in a lot of ways, she has more money, she is more famous. One of my favorite lines in the show is when she enters with her black dress, shoes, and Mr. Black. And one of the brothers, D'Armano, says, "You know you're a star when the shoes, the dress, and the man all match." And
it's a great line.
It's a great, oh, there's so many great lines in it. Queenie, and when Dolores says, "Queenie, my dear, you look absolutely delectable, like a piece of puff pastry someone has taken a bite out of." And Queenie says, "Oh, Dolores, why don't you do the same and bite me?" Mm-hmm. It's, I just, George C. Wolfe knows how to write fucking dialogue.
A lot of catty, sassy, cunty dialogue.
Absolutely.
And it's very satisfying. It's all like straight out of campy drag performances. And
it's the kind of dialogue that Charles Bush has made a living off of by like imitating in a lot of ways.
Completely.
And George C. Wolfe walks that fine line of campy vampiness about it, but also it being earnest because it's also stylized. And right. George C. Wolfe's just a fucking poet. Right. In case you haven't noticed, Adam and I love George C. Wolfe. We are very much into him. Yeah, so we go from best friend into Taboo, which then leads to Black on the fire escape with Queenie, and it's their first solo interaction together.
Are we talking about Low Down Down?
No, it's First Taking Care of the Ladies, where he like gives her what's called the pitch, where he's the mooch, I think it's called.
The mooch. Oh yeah, and they haven't left the apartment yet.
Oh, I thought they were on the fire escape.
They don't go outside until.
Until people like us.
Until people like us.
Okay. So they're in some corner of the apartment.
Mm.
And he's giving her his mooch because it's a playful thing. She's like, "Show me what you do." Like, because it's very clear that he's an escort, that he is Kate's escort. And that she basically owns him. And right. Kate allows him to play with Queenie. She can tell that he's interested in Queenie. She can tell Queenie's interested in him. And Kate's ulterior motives in this party are actually more for Queenie's benefit than for Burz's benefit. Whereas I would say Kate's objective in the Lipa version is very clear cut. Like she wants to steal Burz away.
Right.
The Lacusa one, it's a little more messy. You're not always entirely sure what she's up to or why she's up to it, but it's.
No. And their relationship is purely almost fetishized for her because she gets off on the fact that she's the one who can afford everything and he needs her.
Yes.
As opposed to the other way around.
Oh, I'm not even talking about Black. I'm talking about Kate with Queenie. But yes, that is true with Black as well.
Yes.
It is more of a friendly relationship with Black in the Lipa one.
Yes.
Whereas in Lacusa, they have a history and she gets off on providing for him and making him her houseboy. Mm-hmm. But her ulterior motives for the party align more for Queenie's benefit than for Burz's benefit. We'll get to that at the end. But so yes, Black and Queenie have their moment. We come back to the party.
Similar to the moment in the Lipa version, Maybe I Like It This Way, which is for Queenie in this version, Low Down Down.
Yes.
Where we sort of get a backstory, vague, but just sort of about her being a small town, like living the American dream, essentially, where she, mm-hmm. small town girl who comes to New York and gets beaten up and knocked down and is sort of decidedly stayed where she is mm-hmm. for the moment. So in a lot of ways, it is very much Maybe I Like It This Way, but it's, I don't know. What would you see as the difference?
It is not a declaration, but rather sort of like this. It's the, you almost kind of realize that Queenie is tired. She's, the reason why she has been with Burz is for two reasons. One is that over many years of growing a skin and telling herself that these are the things that she likes, because these are just the things that happened to her, she also is just too exhausted to leave because like she's worked so hard to just survive and be where she's at.
Right. She sort of just gets to the point where she says, it is what it is.
Yeah. Like, I've kicked and screamed my way to this moment, and this is still as far as I got. Like,
it's,
I can't.
Yeah. I mean, it's a preface to ultimately her final song, which I know we'll get to, where, mm-hmm. which is called This Is What It Is.
Yeah.
And it's because Low Down Down sort of explores her inability to explore feeling anything, whereas This Is What It Is explores her moment to go deep into everything that she's feeling.
Yes.
Well, that's a lucky break. I steal what I can take and I roll. And I plead. And I die.
it goes, and that leads us to a breaking point with Burrs, where he introduces hard gin, bathtub gin, and many more drugs to the party. And it's the moment when all the facades of everyone who's showed up to this party crumbles down in a brilliant masterfuck of a musical theater montage called Gin/Wild. Every claw comes out, every bite happens, and violence and sex just goes all over the place. May lets out that she knows that Eddie cheats on her, and
with one of my favorite lines in the entire show.
Yep, she goes, you've seen more ass than a toilet seat, and I bet you make them all call you the champ.
So good. And it culminates in the two of them fighting and her slapping him and him knocking her down to the floor.
And on top of all of that, you have Dolores, who informs Queenie of Burrs' past. You see this moment where she says, you know, Burrs was once married to a girl, beat her with the heel of his shoe till her lips turned blue, and that sticks with Queenie for the rest of the night.
Right.
And you see that Kate's trying to get Queenie away from Burrs all, like, now, and really trying to get her out of this toxic relationship, which has another great line that Adam and I love, which is when Queenie turns to Kate and says, "Will you get my life out of your mouth, Kate? It's none of your goddamn business."
Amazing.
Poems. Poetry. So,
don't you mess with my party. You can't take away what's mine. Don't you know it's my party time for the devil to rise and shine. Don't you make my night sober. Don't you tell me I can't get high. Don't you let me go dry. Don't you know that I gotta keep my party.
Why? We have Black as a Moocher, which is, which is when everybody sort of goes into their massive orgy moment. Which
yes.
Is, directly after Gin Wild.
Yes.
And that's when Queenie and Black take the moment to escape and go out to the fire escape to yeah. To sort of have a quiet moment together.
And they sing a wonderful song called People Like Us, and it's really the moment where both of their facades come down completely.
It's the most contemporary song of the show. It's yes. It's very rock ballady.
Yes. And which isn't to say that like it's rocky.
That's not a negative comment.
No, and it's rock ballady compared to everything else in the score, which has been really into the era of the 1920s.
People like us, we slip by through the cracks. We'll never be famous, so who's gonna care? Nobody needs us, and everyone's had us. We're here, but not here. We'll be there, but not there. And where do we
They're allowing their exhaustion to allow for honesty rather than for like complacency.
Right.
And I like that. Let me say that again. They're allowing their exhaustion to give way to honesty rather than complacency. That's right up there with get my life out of your mouth.
and we get I completely agree with you. Sorry.
Yes, and then. After they sing People Like Us, we kind of jumped around with the plot there for a second, but after People Like Us, that's when Sally Murphy finally really does sing. She sings After Midnight Dies, and she says, everything's now coming out into the open, and every character right. then gets their moment of, like, sad truth. So, like, the angry truth came out during Gin Wild, now the sad truth is coming out with right. everybody, which then right. leads to the rape, which leads to everybody going home, which leads to us finding out Sally Murphy's name's not even Sally.
Right.
And Queenie then has this violent attack with Burrs, where basically they have this showdown.
I was just going to say that at the end of that, Burrs asks everyone to leave. The remaining people at the party at this point are Burrs and Queenie, Black, Kate, and unbeknownst to anybody, Dolores.
Dolores, yeah.
But Queenie and Kate have it out, where Kate is really trying to keep Queenie safe and get her the fuck out of there, and Queenie doesn't want to. This is when we get, will you keep my life out of your mouth? It's none of your goddamn business.
No, that line's in Gin Wild, not in this confrontation. Yeah, it also has hey, a couple of aspirin, a gulp of gin, I'll be like brand new, and
sure.
No, I am sick of people telling me what to do.
Right.
Which that line's not on the album, and I wish it was.
Right. Well, we get Kate trying to sway Queenie to get the fuck out of there one more time, mm-hmm. and Burrs coming at her from the other angle, and where she comes at him with the backwards threat of, you know, what are you gonna do, beat me with the heel of your shoe till my lips turn blue, mm-hmm. and which leads to his breakdown in this version. Her to saying that the only way that she's gonna get out of their relationship is by seeing him dead.
So both Queenie and Black, it's not, as opposed to the Lipa version where they have sex with each other because they're like, this is it, this is the heat, this is the moment. Whereas in the Lacusa version, it's sort of like everyone around us is like rattling the cages and like, let's just hole away to get away from it all, which is essentially right. What happens. And Burrs has his giant breakdown with how many women in the world, and he
which is by all counts is a much scarier breakdown.
Yes, because it's alone, it's in this pool of darkness, and he goes back to his trunk and starts to put on his black face, and then the stage goes to black, and after this like 10 minutes of just pure anxiety and dread, we have Eartha Kitt coming out and cutting the tension with it out of the darkness. She goes, all right, who turned out all the lights? Yes. And the lights slowly come up on her, and she sings what is essentially the Lacusa version of The Life of the Party, but it's from Dolores, and it's towards the end of the night, and it's called When It Ends. And the theme of this song is basically, whereas Life of the Party is like, it's all going to end one day, so don't you want to be there as the center of it? And When It Ends is basically like, you stupid privileged little girl, you think you're going to be alive when it ends? Like, you don't, like...
Right. Unless you stand up for yourself, you're going to get buried.
Yes, you're going to get buried, and all the things that you thought matter don't matter. Like, you're not going to have the person you love with you, the person you want to have sex with. You're not going to have your age. You're not going to have your beauty. And even once all that's taken away from you, there are still going to be things that can come at you that could knock you down. You don't know.
Beauty won't matter, and brains won't matter when the world falls apart one cold and starry night. Money won't matter, and love won't matter if you ain't got the balls to fight that one last fight. I can tell you that nobody lasts forever. I've been there and there and there.
It's privilege to not even question your presence, your like existence almost, if that makes sense, or to like question if your existence will matter when it happens, or if you're going to be around when it happens, you know?
Right, the difference between it's all about me being in the middle of it versus the why do you think you're even going to be there in the first place.
Yes, it's literally like Eartha Kitt took Life of the Party and slapped it out of Idina Menzel's mouth. And to be fair, like Life of the Party happens in a moment with Lipa's where not all of the shit has hit the fan yet. So you could argue that there's a reason why it's so kind of, I don't want to say flippant, but flippant. When It Ends really is the culmination of all the crap that has fallen apart. Right. But they both are kind of that, they both sort of represent the energy of their interpretations. And then Dolores walks out the door and survives another day. So what we've come to learn at this point, as everything kind of culminates, is that Kate brings black to sort of jolt Queenie out of her toxic stupor with Burrs. Basically, she basically brings black along in the way that you see in a lot of like really trashy 80s and like kind of a little bit of Showgirls too, that whole like, you know, what's a friend without, if she's not someone who's gonna like send her gigolo over to fuck her best friend to, you know, get her out of her stupor. It's that kind of thing.
Totally.
So Kate brings black to seduce Queenie just so that way Queenie can sort of like remember what not toxic sexual heat is like.
I would actually say, you said Showgirls, I would say that is very much the vibe of Wild Party in terms of the type of people we're dealing with.
Yes.
Like nobody really likable, but people that you kind of root for because they are, there's a quality about them that's enjoyable. But I mean, Showgirls is very much that.
Yeah, there's a fabulousness about their grossness.
Right, and also just the sweaty disgustingness of the situation. Oh,
absolutely. Well, like watching your boyfriend get a lap dance that you paid for, you know?
Right.
It's that kind of thing. And I can touch you,
but you can't touch me.
Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing that like Kate is sort of doing with Queenie. But what's weird is that it's not even like a sexual thing she's getting off on. It's truly a friend trying to help a friend. And she's doing it in a way she knows will actually, you know, help Queenie. She's like, I can't just like send Queenie to, you know, AA. I have to bring a guy who will fuck her so good that she will know
lure her out.
Mm-hmm. And so when she seduces Burrs, it's to distract Burrs while Queenie and Black have their moment. She's like, you know, Kate is smarter than a lot of people in that room. It's what she actually has a lot more in common with Dolores than Queenie does.
Oh, I think it's safe to say that Kate and Dolores are the two smartest people at this particular party.
Absolutely. you don't, and Kate is played by Tanya Pinkins, who's also a Black actress, and it's, I think it was very intentional by Lacusa and Wolf to have these women play these roles and have the races be they were, to say for these women to survive and thrive in this time, mm-hmm. they had to have been smarter and tougher than everyone else around them, and which you see in the writing, you hear it in the writing. Anyway, so all this happens, we come to the final scene. Queenie and Black have had sex. Queenie is singing This Is What It Is. She's starting to feel, it's not like gushy because she's not like, I feel whole, but it's, she's understanding what lightness is and actually what being happiness is. And
well, it's finally clicked for her that she needs to get out and get on.
Yes.
Like, move on.
Yes. She's like, it's what it's like to be lost, but not in a way that is toxic. But it's, you know, it's a good kind of lost. And she has a little moment with Black, and we'll get to something that was actually cut when it finally opened on Broadway. Because they, this Wild Party, when it started previews, was like a solid, I think you said it was like 2 hours and 45 minutes with no intermission.
Something
and
they, like that, yeah.
And over the course of a month, they had to make like massive, massive cuts to get
they it. They ultimately slashed about 50 minutes out of it.
Yeah. And some of that also just comes down to tempo. Like when you listen to audio from the B-roll footage, which is like towards the end of previews, the tempos are a lot slower, and then when you listen to it once it was closed, when it was closing, the tempos are a lot faster. So there's an energy and there's a heat that comes into it, and that also works in the idea of it being this, you know, it's one whole night and it's the energy sort of riling up and up and up. But it's a quiet moment now at the end. There's a bit of the scene that got cut that's now back in the script that we'll get to in part two. Mm-hmm. And then Burr's Black is about to take off Queenie's makeup, her mask of snow, and then Burrs comes in his blackface, interrupts the party, and brings out a gun, and there's not even a kerfuffle. It's just 2 minutes of pure, like, anxiety, because whereas the Lipa version, it's a full-blown five-minute song of everyone's inner monologues in this moment. There is no real singing in this. There is music. There is tense underscoring.
Right. But
while Burrs has the gun, it's just dialogue. And when you listen to the cast recording, you just hear Toni Collette as Queenie crying and pleading. Because like when there's a gun in your face and you know the person holding the gun is perfectly capable of shooting you, all you can do is beg.
Right.
All you can do is beg and plead. And it's really, it does not let you feel comfortable or even let you feel musically fulfilled. It's just like, no, this is a very unsure moment. But Black seizes the gun and shoots Burrs. And then a giant chaos happens with everyone sort of coming back out. And this is another moment from Follies where it's almost like a regurgitation of everything we just saw.
Right.
It's like the bile is finally coming out and it all cuts away. And Queenie sings sort of a mini mashup reprise of Queenie was a blonde in a vaudeville show. She hid what she was with a mask of snow and then sings a little bit of This Is What It Is.
Right.
This is what it is to live in light.
And right, which she had previously not finished in the first time that she actually sings the song.
Yes.
But the end of the show is having the light shed and her removing her mask herself. She wipes her makeup off.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess sort of looks hopefully into the future. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, it says, Queenie is bathed in morning light, scared, unsure, but hopeful. She smiles at the dawn. And... Mm-hmm. Whereas the Lipa version, Queenie ends by finally walking out the door in a big, like, Nora Doll's House moment. This is hopeful in the same way, but it's not a defiant hopeful. It's a finally living in what makes you uncomfortable and, like, growing from that moment onward kind of hopeful. And the show is over. Toni Collette is a Broadway star and wins a Theater World Award and wins a Tony. Oh, wait a second. No, she didn't. She lost a Tony to Heather Headley, who was wonderful in Aida, but I think about Toni Collette's performance, and I didn't even see it live, but I think about her performance maybe once a week.
Well, and isn't it crazy that, I mean, I guess doing film is probably easier for someone's schedule, but I mean, we could have had Toni Collette, the Broadway star, and I think if the Wild Party had been a better experience for her, she probably would have done
way more. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think now's a good time as any to take that break, that intermission, and come back for part two where we analyze the two now and decide for once and for all, which is the better Wild Party. All right. Shall we?
Sounds good.
All right. See you on a hot second.
They were having a wild, wild party.
And they
were loving it loud and fast.
They
were having a wild, wild party and hoping the beer would last.
Hey, what's on tap?
They were driving it fast and funky.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.